Well, thank you all for coming today. It's good to see so many already so many faces I recognize out there. So being asked to share on faith and vocation is probably the most intimidating topic that I'll be talking about this semester. Speaking about memory and the neuroscience of decision making is pales in comparison to the gravity of what I'm talking about today. Now, that's not to say that I'm going to offer you, I felt like I was preparing a bit of a graduation speech, so I hope you don't come to this looking for really grand proclamations about what you should do to correctly unify faith and vocation. Because the funny thing about being asked to share on these big topics is that you guys are all facing these exact same questions and certainly have as much insight as I do. So I've maybe just been working on some of these questions for a few years longer than some of you and dramatically fewer years than some others of you. So these are questions that I'm still certainly figuring out. And from what I hear, that doesn't really change. So rather, again, than giving any sort of grand take-home advice, I'm just going to give you a couple of anecdotes from my own story, and hopefully these can be, you can gain some insight, or maybe take what you will from my story. So to start, a little bit of background. I was born and raised in Goshen. I attended College Mennonite Church from birth. I attended Bethany Christian High School and then went just down the railroad tracks to Goshen College, where I played baseball, participated in Amish. For those of you that are not familiar, that's the Association of Mennonites Interested in Street Hockey. And had a short-lived tenure in the Goshen Intellectual Society. It was a self-proclaimed intellectual society, and I think our marquee moment was wearing sport coats to chapel and demanding that the board, that we be allowed to vet all presidential candidates from the board. But that's neither here nor there. So really, if there was a Goshen Mennonite credential, I had it, right? I was right down the pipeline. Baptism, however, was still something that was very much on hold by the time I entered college. Okay, so smash cut to my vocational background. Just as I was born into the Mennonite world, I was also born into academia. My dad was a professor at Goshen for almost 30 years, and my mom's last job pre-retirement was at the registrar of Associated Mennonite Biblical Seminary. So I really want to drive home the point that from birth it at least seemed like I had Mennonite academia locked down. So let me just say up front that this is probably this is almost the hardest thing for me to disclose publicly because it feels a bit like defeat. I have so many times throughout my college, high school, and professional career been presented with the phrase, following in your father's footsteps, which is good, which is great. I love my dad very much. But again, it kind of paints a very linear picture of my journey that I definitely did not feel while I was going through it. So the general theme that I'm going to present today is that my moments of greatest clarity have generally come when I've been away from these two communities. Now, I want to be very careful to avoid being trite and give you another cliche, get out of your comfort zones, talk. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Those are wonderful talks. But I'm going to give you two short anecdotes, and I'm going to phrase these as opportunities to step back and take stock. So the summer following my sophomore year, I went on Goshen's version of cross-cultural, which is known as SST. And SST is structured such that in the second half of your semester, more or less, you're going to be out on your own, kind of in a village, living with a host family, and doing some sort of service. And I quickly realized, and I didn't really think about this going into it, that this was really the first time in all my life that I wasn't completely surrounded by Mennonites and by Mennonite academics. And although I had sort of felt, I guess, somewhat constrained and somewhat sometimes chafed under community. I remember having multiple talks with one of my housemates in college, and they all ended with, community can just stay out of my business. But then I realized I missed it. I missed it a lot. And so I didn't even actually, I hadn't even thought about this when Danny talked to me on Sunday about what would be a good hymn, what was some of my favorite hymns that he could play today. And I came out with When Peace Like a River. And it's a very fitting song, because on SST, what I would do a couple weeks into the service is, on Sunday mornings, I realized that I really missed going to church. I really missed having that community around. So I would take my little hymnal that I borrowed from our service leaders, and I'd walk down to a river that was near the place where I was serving, and there was this little island of rocks out in the middle of a river, and I would just kind of sit there on my own and page through some of my favorite hymns and spend time in prayer and singing. It was kind of by myself, and it probably looked very odd, but yeah, it was an amazing experience. And I think that was one of the first times when I didn't realize how unique my college experience was, how unique my community was, and kind of by, again, getting out of that and, yeah, having an opportunity to take stock allowed me to really start to take ownership of my faith and of my faith tradition. Okay, so I'm going to do another quick transition now to my period of vocational insight. And if it seems like I'm telling two very different stories or two separate stories, that's intentional, because for a long time, and I would say this is something that I'm still certainly wrestling with, those have been two completely different tracks, the professional and the spiritual. So, following college, I did a year of Mennonite voluntary service, because apparently I was playing a game of Mennonite institutional bingo that no one else was, but I think I've won at this point. So I've got MVS checked off. And when I was graduating, people always ask me, like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do after college? And I had no idea. But one of my favorite responses was, I'll tell you what I'm not going to do. I am not going to go into psychology. And that worked out very well for me. So I'm in VS, and I work for this really interesting organization that leads short-term immersive learning trips. So I worked out of Tucson, Arizona, and we led groups down into Nogales and into Mexico. So I did a lot of interpreting and all sorts of things, and it was great, and it was completely different from any other organization that I've ever worked with. However, again, this opportunity to step back, I think, allowed me to get some insight. So I had a few conversations with the CEO of the organization, who is also a Reiki healer, and she explained to me a couple times how various emotions lived in the fingers, and a very good therapeutic way to get rid of said emotions was to squeeze that specific finger and shake out the emotion. So just to name a few, like sadness lives in your thumb. I think you can all guess what lives in your middle finger. So that actually was the argument. And I quickly came to realize that I looked at the world as an empirical psychologist. So there'd be all sorts of debates in this organization. How can we get the best learning outcomes? What are the best trips that we can take these people on? And people would kind of argue back and forth, and sometimes they get very heated. And I was just like, why don't we collect data? Why don't we just, you know, why don't we do this? And we would propose projects, and all of a sudden I realized that all the projects I was proposing was using the skills that I learned as a senior psychology major at Goshen. And again, I was just like, I could see it coming. And I couldn't stop it. And from that point on, I decided to start exploring graduate school more specifically and ended up getting into a program at Miami University in Ohio. So even through that time, so that allowed me, again, to kind of take ownership again, to step back and take ownership of, I guess, yeah, really who I was and what I was good at. And throughout graduate school, I think there's a reputation that when you're in the sciences, that religion is sort of a bit of a taboo topic. And I wouldn't say that my graduate experience was at all hostile to religion or to faith. It just wasn't something that existed there. It was completely kind of outside the realm of my professional relationships there. So I was in grad school at Miami and attending church about 45 minutes away at Cincinnati Mennonite, which was great, but again, it felt like these two domains were completely segregated. And that was something that continued throughout my graduate career, throughout my postdoc at Syracuse. And I came to realize that it was really important for me to find a way to integrate these. So I think the most concrete way, the obvious way, is like now I have a job at EMU, which is great, and I love it. But I'm still trying to figure out a way to continually, how does my faith inform what I do as a researcher? As a psychologist. That's something I'm definitely still struggling with. I had a great conversation with Dee last night, and she made the point that what you're studying affects how you view faith. And so I was thinking about that a lot last night, and I want to close with two examples from the psychological literature that I get pretty excited about, and they're places where I see, I guess, my faith informing how I interpret or how I view research findings. But again, this is definitely something I'm still working on. So there's this really cool study by Dan Ariely, where what he did is he brought people into a room, they're doing some sort of perceptual task, and he says, look, our computer tracking system is broken, so you're just going to have to report how many of these questions you get right. And again, as always, you're going to get paid on the basis of how many correct answers you have. And what you see is, so obviously the computer's not broken because we're psychologists and we're tricky. So what you see is you see a plot like this, where if this is cheating, or like the reporting increase in correct answers that weren't actually there. So you see it start really low, and gradually it builds, and it builds, and it builds, and it builds. Now right here, Ariely did something interesting. He stopped the experiment and says, look, we know that sometimes cheating happens, we just want to give you the opportunity to, if you were cheating, you can just own up to it, and it's fine, everything will be okay. And after this, people that do the, because there are some cheaters, and they're just like, yes, screw it, I'm going big, right? But there are these other people that confess, and what you see is the cheating rate drops back to baseline, and then slowly starts to build again, right? But this is really cool. And from this, I take, you know what, there is, as much as we sometimes chafe at capital C church, the institution, but there is some institutional wisdom, right? So this, you can think about like the tradition of confession in the Catholic faith, right? That's just really cool. It's kind of like this opportunity to, release what you're doing wrong and go back to baseline. And the other example that I really want to talk about really quickly is, as a decision researcher, there's this finding that we can classify people or describe people as having different decisional styles. You can be a satisficer or a maximizer. So a satisficer are people that are just like, you know what? What's good enough, this is good enough. I don't need to explore all my options. And a maximizer is like, I need to explore the entire decision space because I need to get the best of the best. Now, if you're going to guess, which one of those would also be correlated with life happiness? Does anyone want to take a shot? Matt does. Satisficing. Because we're at a Mennonite institution, and what is more Mennonite than satisficing and living simply? But again, it's this idea that like there are data out there that sort of, not necessarily confirm, but sort of, support some of the faith traditions that we have, and they're not just kind of randomly up there to make lives difficult. There's goodness in them, and I get really excited about that. So thanks.
Well, I have to say I found inspiration much in talking with Jeff Greg last night, too. And I think that what he had to say is very lovely, and I connect with a lot of it. I connect with his idea of finding God in nature. I think that's one of my favorite hymns is For the Beauty of the Earth. That came from my childhood. Kind of like Greg, I'm going to do the same thing where I'm going to tell you some things about my professional life, my childhood, things that happened to me, and some things about my faith, and then maybe in the end they'll come together. A lot of you know that my father was a rodeo cowboy. I was born in Casper, Wyoming. I come by these boots honestly, right? I grew up in these wide open spaces, which you just don't see here, except on my drive to EMU. I get to look out over the Shenandoah Valley when I go over Afton Mountain, which where I come from, that would be a hill. I'm sorry, it's a hill. But, you know, it still has that big, wide open sky that I love. And I grew up out in those kind of places with billowing clouds where God felt always present. I went to church in this little multi-denominational chapel where you looked out and the front of the church was all windows. And so when someone was speaking, and it was a different person all the time, God was moving behind them in nature, just like, you know. And this was my mystic beautiful, wonderful wrapping up of God, and still is where my heart lies and where I see God. I was, you know, one of the big components of my life experience is that I'm almost always different. I was different on the ranch I grew up in. I was a nerd. I read books all the time. I was different when I moved at 13 to the big city of Phoenix, which maybe you don't think of as a big city, but it's a pretty big city. And there were cars there that went over 10 miles per hour, and that was scary as all get out. I can remember standing on the side of a street corner and refusing to cross. My mother, horrified, she had my two younger brothers who were reasonable and walked with her, and I refused. I was not going across there. That was way too dangerous. So it was very different. At this time in my life on the ranch, and even in high school, God was He. He was a benevolent Father. He was everyone's Father, multi-denominational, but God was He. Also, right before I moved to the big city when I was about 12, I read for the first time, I've read it four times, okay, read for the first time the trilogy of The Lord of the Rings. That's important for later, so kind of keep that in mind. It's also around this time that I started to realize that I needed to pray, that when I was praying, I needed to pray, if it should be thy will. I needed to end in this, because I didn't always know what I really wanted. I didn't really know what God had in mind for me. I came to understand that often God moved in mysterious ways, and that often He knew what was better for me. So I moved to Phoenix. I was very weird there. I was slightly odd on the ranch, but in Phoenix I was just downright weird. I was a woman who was good at math, and why would any woman in their right mind, or girl in their right mind, admit that to anyone? And certainly none of them would actually help guys with their math. That was extremely strange. I was a horsewoman, a runner, and a band member. I played the flute. And somehow I never really fit in, but I always fit in, because somehow I've never expected to fit in. I think that's because I've been very lucky, and I've always felt like God was in my life. And I think, you know, I come from a Presbyterian tradition. I was baptized as an infant, and I guess maybe that worked, because I've always felt like God is right there. You know, God's right here, standing here now, pushing me, making me finish on time, hoping I'm revealing God to you in some way, in some small way, that your heart is opened to God. And that's both lucky and completely and totally annoying, okay? In college, I used to argue with God in my bed late at night. I used to talk to Him about Scripture. We'd always be talking about Scripture in InterVarsity. I belonged to that, but I felt very out of place. I felt like that group at that particular time was so involved in Scripture in deciding who was in and who was out. Okay, this felt like a Pharisee to me, and I just wasn't willing to play that role. I just wasn't willing to go there. So God kept prodding me to look deeper, to, yes, go with my gut, but to think about it, to figure it out, to really try to understand it more deeply. And I'm still struggling to do that. And He still is, you know, whispering in my ear. I ended up in college always somehow being the counselor, the person that people came to, the person that people wanted to talk to. I came home one night from a late study night, and on my door was a sign that said, Mental Health Distribution Association, free hugs. And someone else wrote it, but that kind of tells you a bit of who I was. I struggled then because a lot of my male lab partners wouldn't let me touch the lab components. They wouldn't let me participate in study groups, and I felt very odd. Of the six female friends I had that started out in engineering, I was the only one who actually graduated in engineering. So I've always been a little bit different, a little bit stubborn, a little bit unwilling to give. I got a job in Austin, Texas after college, and I started looking for a spiritual home. I looked everywhere. I tried almost every denomination. Unfortunately, I didn't try the one I was born in. That probably would have been a good try. But, you know, a good place to start. But I was trying to be real. I was trying to do that wide search and get that best fit. And so I ended up, along the way, becoming a certified Hatha yoga teacher, going to the Unitarian Church, and a lot of places. I had trouble finding God, but where I saw it in all those places was not in any one place, but in every person who was taking their faith seriously and working hard at it to find truth. So I'm going to come back here quickly to this idea of, first I want to mention C.S. Lewis. I read Mere Christianity about this time, and I love C.S. Lewis. He's great. Read more of him. But I have a bone to pick with him, and that is this. In Mere Christianity, he draws this line, and he puts a point on it, and he says, "There is a faith that is closer to the truth than all others, because there is only one point on a line that can be as close to any other, you know, is a certain distance from any other point." Well, the mathematician in me really freaked out, you know? I said, wait a minute, there's the other side of the line even. And, you know, look, it's a three-dimensional space. It's a multi-dimensional space. And as scientists and engineers, I bet you can kind of relate to that, right? God is multidimensional. And this idea that I learned in yoga came to me, truth is one, paths are many. And I still feel very strongly that way. So I went to graduate school. Again, I was different. I was female. I was mom. I was married. I kept having babies. That was God's plan. I only tried really hard not to have babies, but three of them just came right away. And God planned my family way better than I could have, right? So then I stayed home. So why the heck did I get a PhD in computer science, I asked God. I'm at home taking care of babies and wiping bottoms and noses. Well, then the economy crashed. My husband lost a lot of consulting work. And he insisted, oddly in church, that I apply to EMU. I was on my way, and God was involved. I am here now. It is my dream come true. So now let me jump to a quick story that doesn't seem connected, right? Remember Tolkien, right? Lord of the Rings. So I have a favorite moment, and I've been thinking about this moment a lot since I've been watching these movies again and reading the books again. In it, and you probably won't be surprised, right? It's in Return of the King when Eowyn, you know, the niece of the daughter, is fighting in battle, and she's in her knight's outfit, and you can't tell. She's just another soldier, but she's using her brain. She's using her professional skills. She's a knight of Rohan. She is winning, helping win the battle. But then the Nazgul comes down and is going to devour her king, her uncle. And she steps in, an arbitrary knight. But it's not because she's an arbitrary knight she could step in. It's not because she's a professional. It's because she loves her king. She loves her father. She steps in. She pulls off her helmet. And of course, what does she say? After the Nazgul yells at her, "No man can kill me," she says, "I am no man." And she reveals her whole womanhood, her whole self, her heart, her love of her king, of what is right. And professionally, she killed him. All right, so she brings her whole self in. But I think there's more even there to Eowyn's defiance. Eowyn isn't just saying, "I am no man." She is saying, "I am the one to defeat evil. I am the one to step in." She's saying, "I am no man. I am the one that will fight for my king and for God's kingdom." So I think God is a multidimensional God. He comes from all different angles. You know, would you recognize this face from just the top? That's how faith is. We see dimly, we see in one dimension now, but eventually we will see in all dimensions. For me, God is not only no man, God is no woman, no white, no black, no Christian, no Mennonite, no Jew, no Muslim. Indeed, God is all of this and more. God is infinite. Indeed, not just countably infinite, but uncountably infinite. Many of you will get that part. What I want to tell you is that we are all a little piece of God, a part of the great I Am. Don't be afraid to say, I am. You do not have to check your head at the door of the temple or your heart at the door of the lab. Bring your whole self to do the work of the Lord and seek truth. It is the goal of both our professions and our faith to seek this truth. So thank you. Sorry I went too long.